I admit that's very, very selfish on my part. We are going to put on the World Cup finals game immediately following the service in here. So if you're not a fan, you can still stick around, hang out. We're going to serve popcorn. There's also tomatoes on the bagel tables. You might have seen those. Those were grown, most of them, on the church balcony in little garden boxes. Pretty cool. So there you go. Take advantage of the World Cup, popcorn, friends, tomatoes. I've titled this, Good Things Come From Others' Wisdom. Receiving wisdom from other people can be difficult. Some of the earliest wisdom I remember receiving was from my older brother. I was probably 4 or 5 years old at the time. My dad was pouring us glasses of Coca-Cola. And Coke or pop of any kind was a rare treat for me when I was a young kid growing up. But this was a Friday night. It was movie night. And dad had bought bottles, glass bottles of Coca-Cola, one for each of us. I'm watching my dad pour this, and I'm anticipating this awesome sugary drink. And I tell my dad, Dad, give me lots and lots of ice. And he said, why do you want lots of ice? And I said, because I want more pop. Duh. My wise older brother started laughing and jeering at me and said something like, you don't get more ice or more pop with more ice, stupid. Don't you understand volume displacement? I didn't. But I did after this very wise advice, though ill-given, and I've never forgotten volume displacement, so it's been helpful. I've been a pastor here at Sanctuary for about 7 years, and through the years have been a lot of times when I've leaned on the wisdom of our senior pastors, Tom and Adie Wasink, for their wisdom, their advice, and this hasn't always been easy. Not so much because of how they've given me wisdom, they've been much better than my older brother at age 7, it hasn't always been easy because not infrequently I've had to deal with my own resistance to submitting to someone else's perspective. I'm a fairly principled person, or at least that's the story I tell myself. And I'm generally convinced I'm right. Again, the story I tell myself. So when I've had competing visions of what I thought would be good or helpful, and Adie and Tom have suggested something else, I've had to re-examine what's going on inside of me. I've had to be curious about my own self, my identity, my desires, my motivations, and I've had to humble myself and consider someone else's perspective, someone who's probably wiser than me. Receiving advice or wisdom is fraught, even when it's good advice. And we would do well to ask ourselves questions like, what is the advice that we're willing to receive? When does it come to us? From whom? How does it come to us? What is the advice we might resist, or the wisdom we might resist receiving? And then how do we sort through what is wisdom from what's just bad advice? And how do we know which to run with and which to reject? Here's a verse from the book of Proverbs in the Bible. It says this, Proverbs 4, verse 7. The beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom. I love this verse. Though it costs you all you have, get understanding, right? Get wisdom. This means God invites us to be people who are open to receiving wisdom and input, open to submitting to other people's points of view. And it often can cost us a lot. It can cost us how we see ourselves. It can cost us our sense of our own story, what we're doing, where we're going. But the results can be very good when we adjust to other people's wisdom and take it and run with it. So this morning we're going to consider the good benefits of listening to other people's wisdom. And we're going to look at a story that kind of flips everything on its head. Because we're going to look at a story of Jesus, but it's a story where Jesus is not dispensing wisdom. He is on the receiving end of someone who has some wisdom for him. And he has to choose whether he's going to follow the wisdom or not. And the wisdom, to make it doubly difficult, is from his own mom. So, here we go. I chose this story. It's from John chapter 2. And we studied this at our men's retreat, which we had a few weeks ago. So shout out to all the men at the men's retreat. All right. Yeah. That's about right. I swear it was much better than that response. But we had a really, really fun, meaningful time studying the story we're gonna look at, and I'm using a lot of the insights that came out of that Bible study, because it was discussion-based, so it relied heavily upon all the insights from the group, and that's exactly what I'm using here. So this is like, you know, tricks of the trade of preachers. We just kind of borrow and steal everything and then figure out a way to present it. So there we are. At least I'm self-disclosing that, or, you know, where it came from. So men's retreat, thank you for the insights. These are great. So here we go, John chapter 2, starting verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now standing there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. I love that detail. He said to them, "Now draw some out. Take it to the chief steward." So they took it. When the steward tasted the water that had become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you've kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this, the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and revealed his glory. And his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother, his brothers, and his disciples, and they remained there a few days. Okay, so this is chapter 2. It's very, very early on in John's telling of the story, the life of Jesus. It is Jesus' first sign, his first miracle, and it happens at a party. He changes water into wine to keep the wedding feast going on. This is what God looks like among humans. God is at a party. God turns water into wine. God brings joy wherever humans gather. But as we read the story, Jesus seems like an unwilling participant in this joy-producing miracle. The party is in a critical danger phase. Okay, the keg has run dry. And Jesus seems totally clueless about this. Okay, Jesus is sitting there with his friends, the disciples. He's, you know, drinking his glass of wine, hanging out with friends, eating. And his mom comes over and alerts him to the fact that the wine has run out. And so I want to put these verses back up, this interaction. It's pretty brilliant. Here, let me read again. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what concern is that to you and to me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Okay, so our Bible study at the men's retreat, we had a long conversation about this interaction. I'm sure we were working out all the issues we had with our own mothers as this conversation was going on. At least I was. Okay. But, okay, first of all, detail. Jesus' mom is never named. Okay, she's called the mother of Jesus. So even though she plays this really crucial, critical role, she's only referred to in relationship to Jesus. She's the mother of Jesus. Now, we know from other stories in the Bible and from tradition that it's Mary, the mother of Jesus. But it's fascinating and kind of ironic. On one hand, it makes sense because John's telling the story of Jesus. Jesus is the protagonist, the main character. It's his good news. But, like, you know, Mary's playing a really big role here. Could you have named her? I don't know. Secondly, Jesus seems to treat his mom with, I don't know, a little bit of dismissiveness, maybe? Maybe you might use a stronger word. I'll let you figure that out at lunch. But he calls her woman, not mom, not, oh, ma, just woman. And he says pretty confidently and dismissively, "My hour has not yet come." He understands that she's asking him to do something. And he's like, no. You know, my hour has not yet come. I'm not going to do it. And he's very confident in his own assessment of the situation, huh? It's not my time. Now, his mom does not even respond to him. Can we take a moment? Can we just Let's marvel at this pro parenting from Mary. This is World Cup finals level parenting right here from Mary, the mother of Jesus. She does not even acknowledge it. I mean, you know, every parent knows there's a moment when your kid says something to you and it's like, that's not quite right. And I'm just not going to, you know, deal with that. I'm going to ignore it. They'll figure it out eventually. Tell me if I'm wrong here, but this is how I'm reading this. I mean, she does not respond to him and just says to the servants, do whatever he tells you. In other words, he'll figure it out. Just give him a moment. So let's just sit with Jesus in that minute. Okay? His mom has just alerted him to the fact that the wine's gone out. She knows he can do something. And it's not go over to Walgreens and buy a couple boxes of wine. Okay? It's do something. And he understands it too. He's saying, my hour has not yet come. It's not time for me to, what, reveal myself, to put on display who I am, what I can do. It's not my time. And, you know, on the other hand, like, it's a party. It's a wedding party. You know, you can save the wedding. This sweet young couple, their families. You know, let's keep the party going. You can almost feel this internal tension in Jesus. He has a decision to make. Will he listen to the wisdom of his mom? Or will he lean on his own understanding of his, of the situation, of himself, of his timing? Jesus' mom, it turns out, is very clever in what she says to the servants. When she turns to the servants and says, do whatever he tells you, she has provided him a way for him to do it stealthily and quietly. Because now he actually doesn't have to put on display what he's going to do. He only has to work with the servants. And he can do it all in the background with their help. They are co-conspirators in the miracle of water to wine. So whatever happens inside Jesus in that moment, ultimately he decides to submit to the wisdom of his mom. He has the servants fill large stone bins of water. These are the vessels of religious purity. And he fills them with water and makes it become wine. Hashtag metaphor. Now, each of these vessels is 20 to 30 gallons. And I have a prop. It's a big one. Here it is. 30 gallons. This is it. Okay, so check it out. All right, there are five or six of these guys. It would take a long time for servants to fill that, first of all. You know, I mean, they would have to be very deliberate about doing this. It's not like you have a garden hose. You know, they're running buckets, filling these up to the brim. And Jesus changes it all to wine. It's about 800 bottles of wine. 800 bottles. And it's really good wine, too. It's not the Coors Light of wine. Sorry, Coors Light drinkers. I'll back off. But it tastes so good, the steward's like, whoa. Most people serve the good wine first, and then after half the people at the party are drunk, you bring out whatever. But this is good stuff. So the party is saved. Jesus reveals his glory. His glory of keeping a wedding party going. His glory of bringing joy. His glory of working with servants quietly and stealthily to reveal his glory, but not to everybody. The servants, the disciples. And all of this happens because Jesus is willing to submit to the wisdom of someone else, his mom. This miracle, changing water into wine, is as much attributable to Mary as it is to Jesus. I mean, sure, Jesus has the power. Let's not diminish that. He has the power to do it, and he does it, but he doesn't take the initiative. It's not his idea. He doesn't see the need, nor does he really want to do anything publicly. But Mary sees it. She perceives the opportunity. She names it with him. And even when he pushes back and calls her a woman, she presses on and figures out, oh, there's a way you could do this quietly. Come on. This is a story that demonstrates Jesus' great power. Jesus can bring wine. And we can discover new wine in our lives when the wine has run out. There's new wine that's possible that Jesus can bring. It's also, though, a story of Jesus submitting, of Jesus' humility, a story that invites us to consider the benefits of following the wisdom that comes from others. It's as though John is saying, hey, disciples, you know, hey, people who follow Jesus, even Jesus submitted to the wisdom of other people. How much more shall we be open to wisdom when it comes our way? About 14 years ago, my wife Allie and I were at a crossroads, and we were looking for wisdom. This was before we had children, and we lived in Iowa City, where we still live. Allie was teaching at Tipton High School. She now teaches at City High. And I was working at a job that I did not enjoy. I didn't see any prospects for that improving, both in short-term and long-term. There wasn't a lot of movement possible in the job either. And it felt like my daily life was, the wine has run out. Party's over. You ever feel like that? I had trouble finding joy, just the day-to-day routine. At the time, I was also taking classes at North Park Seminary, which is in Chicago, so I was doing a distance education program. Most of my courses were online, and then I could travel to Chicago to do one-week intensive coursework, one-week-long classes. Because I wasn't happy with my job or finding joy, I became convinced that Allie and I needed to move to Chicago. We needed to relocate to Chicago so that I could engage my studies full time, as most seminary students do. They do it full time. And that would allow me to finish seminary to get my master's in divinity and then go find a church job, a pastoring job, church ministry job, whatever you want to call it. And I felt like if I did that, my water would turn to wine. I would find joy again, or so I thought. So I began sharing this with Allie, and Allie had a very different perspective. She thought our life was just great. We loved each other. We still do. We had amazing friends, an amazing church community. We were part of this church community. She loved her job, loved teaching. And we both loved the quirky Iowa City area. Our roots were going deeper and deeper as we lived life together in this place within this community. And she pushed back, and she would ask me, like, why would we uproot ourselves for a short time in Chicago and then have to uproot again if you found a church job? She also pointed out, more importantly, how often I expressed uncertainty about a career in ministry, which was very true, and I didn't mention this. Because in those moments of anxiety about my own job and frustration about where I was at, I would dismiss or diminish the amount of doubt or uncertainty I had about a career in ministry. But if you had asked me at the time, I would have told you, I have no idea if I actually want to do church ministry. Like, maybe. It's a great perhaps. And that's why I was in part-time. I didn't know. I was exploring. And so she said, well, why would we uproot ourselves even though you aren't really certain you want to do this? So there's a big tension, and I was wrestling internally, which was pretty intense at times. So were mine and Allie's conversations at times, kind of intense. The stakes felt very high, and it was not easy. And ultimately, I felt like I had to choose. I had to choose between trying to make this thing fit, this idea of mine, a career that I thought would make me happy, that would make me successful. Or I could choose to listen to the wisdom of my wife, of Allie, and submit to her. As I prayed and journaled, and I talked to my spiritual director, I talked with many other friends, and I sensed from Jesus an invitation, and it was this: listen to your wife. Listen to your wife. It will go well for you. And that's what I did. I said, okay. We stayed here. I kept on this sort of winding road of coursework. It took me 6 years to finish my seminary degree. It usually takes 3 if you do it full time. And during that time, I had to come to terms with a lot of things about myself. I had to come to terms with the degree to which I was putting stock in an image of success that I had, and how that, I thought, would make me happy. I had to come to terms with what is success? What is career? Why am I attaching joy to that? In those years, Allie and I adopted both our boys. And because I was in school part-time and didn't like my job, and Allie loved her job, she said, hey, what if you quit your job and stayed home, became the primary caregiver? And once again, I thought, I don't know, but I guess I'll listen to your wisdom on this. So sure, let's try it. And I did. And there were some very challenging things about becoming the primary caregiver. I know, newsflash. But there were also some really amazing, amazing gifts about those years with my young kids. I discovered Jesus was turning water into wine all over the place. It was mostly secret. It was mostly hidden. I had to go look for the new wine that Jesus had for me. And I found it. I was like the servants in this story, seeing the water fill to the brim, and then suddenly it's wine. The wonder, the joy. We spent those years building deep, authentic relationships with great friends in this church community, and our cups were overflowing. Now, soon after I finished seminary, I started as a half-time pastor in this church. Now, I know that, like I tell this story, it seems kind of obvious. Well, no doubt, but I have to tell you, I had no idea that would be possible. It had never occurred to me that I would, like, end up having a job in the church we were part of. It didn't occur to me. It was totally a surprise. But here I am. It's funny to me. Okay. Now, it very well could be that had Allie and I chosen to move, we would have found the new wine of Jesus wherever we go. That's true. And many people move for good reasons. Okay, so please don't hear this as a story against moving or anything like that. For me, it was more about, can I be open to the wisdom and input of others that comes my way, even when it will cost me a lot? So what is the wisdom that's coming your way now? What will it look like to welcome wisdom in your life, to embrace it, to follow it? What is Jesus saying to you about the wisdom that comes your way? Let me suggest a few ways, just a few practical things. Number one, be open to input and wisdom, right? Jesus is open. That's it. And it's remarkable, right? I mean, Jesus is the most wise person to have ever existed. Jesus is the most powerful person to have ever existed. Pretty special. And maybe what made him powerful and wise is that he was willing to listen to others and receive input. And it could be that those with most power among us humans don't tend to do well with power. I don't know if you've noticed that. And maybe are most tempted to not listen to wisdom when it comes our way. But not Jesus. Jesus is humble. He is open. Quick word of warning. We can read other stories in the Bible where Jesus gets wisdom, quote unquote, and he rejects it. He's like, no. And he does what he knows is best. But he's open. He weighs it, right? That's the thing. Number two, weigh the input and who's giving it. We don't follow advice uncritically. We weigh it. Jesus even pushes back initially on the advice he's getting in this story. But when he weighs it, he recognizes the wisdom and runs with it. And number three, we can evaluate wisdom based on what we expect the results will be. What we expect the results will be. The results from our story are glorious. I mean, we get one of the best stories ever. I mean, water into wine, that's pretty cool. And we get it because Jesus was open and willing to listen to wisdom. He saw the results. He could see what could happen from what he could do. And as Allie and I weighed our own story, that crossroads moment, we were looking at the results. What would the results be if we stayed in this church community, stayed with our friends, stayed in a job and a career that Allie loved, and give priority to Allie, who was very confident in her career choice, who was bearing lots and lots of fruit. And I felt Jesus saying, can you support her? You know? All right, as we often do, I'd like to lead us in a prayer exercise, a simple prayer exercise as we come to a close. So we're just going to take a moment to listen to Jesus and hear some wisdom. So go ahead and get comfortable in your chair, whatever you need to do to get comfortable. Shake out your arms and legs. You can take a few breaths and close your eyes if that's helpful. If not, that's fine. And please join me as we pray. We recognize your presence here, O God. Would you help us even now to hear from you? I invite you to take a moment to name a challenge or name a problem that you're facing right now. What's the challenge or problem? Maybe it's a difficult relationship. Maybe you're at a crossroads of some kind. What's the challenge? Just name that before God. And then what advice or wisdom has come your way? And what does God have to say about that wisdom or advice? What's the invitation for you? God, those places in our lives where it feels like the wine has run out, we call out to you. We recognize your power available to us, Jesus, and we long for moments where we encounter you, encounter your power. Help us to become co-participants in what you're doing. Help us to be open to the wisdom that comes our way, the wisdom that is ultimately from you. Pray this in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.